It pleased the court. I apologize for the delay. I had some technical difficulties, and I'm now unfortunately having to work off my phone, which seems like the last resort, but the one I'm forced to take. May it please the court. This is both a simple case and a very complex case, as it follows an extensive trial which adjudicated a number of overlapping facts concerning the matters here involving the CDPH and Dr. Chaudhry. In effect, just to provide some context, Dr. Chaudhry phenomenally lost the Perez case, in part because of disclosure of a report that was exceedingly damaging.
Can I push back on that on a number of fronts?
You may.
Because, you say it was because of that report, and yet I thought that the litigation, that he, first of all, Perez was not notified by the government agency about this incident. There's testimony that I believe you conceded that there was another doctor there at the hospital.
It was leaked by Robillard, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Correct.
So I don't understand how you can put the blame at the feet of the government agency when they weren't even the ones who directly notified Perez about this incident.
I'm providing context, not in terms of the argument here.
Well, because but I don't you have to prove that? I mean, your argument is that there was causation. I think this goes to your whether you've proven causation here. You argue that there was causation for the harm that was in that your client suffered. No question, your client suffered some harm. The question is, what caused it, or one of the questions anyway.
But what caused it was the dissemination locally throughout the hospital of a report which was materially false. The government has the CDPH.
How can you say that? The hospital was investigating. The hospital had asked him to step down as the head of surgery before the government was even notified, or maybe not before they were notified, but certainly before they'd even distributed a report, even a draft report.
So the government was fully involved at that point. The report wasn't issued.
But so how could the report have caused the loss of that position?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I cut you off.
No, you didn't. Go ahead. I was just asking how it could be caused by a report that didn't yet exist.
Well, the damage, the loss of Dr. Chaudhry's position was not nearly all of the damage which occurred. That was only one aspect of the loss of his position. There was a domino effect once this report occurred. After the issuance of the report, the economic damages flowed into many years later. I think it's speculative, to say the least, to attribute it all to the Perez case, especially where you have an amended report that comes out after the damages are done. If I can pedal back a little bit, and because the causality issue is a very important issue in this case, and the court is, I think, focusing on a key aspect of this, which ties in a little bit to Judge O'Neill's prior ruling. But I want to go back to what I think is a couple of the lead issues here. And I'm going to begin and end with the McComb testimony, which I think got very short shrift and a very incorrect ruling by Judge Boone. The notion, as I understand that ruling, that there is not a successor in interest. Dr. Chaudhry is not a successor in interest in terms of the Perez plaintiffs. And that's just fundamentally incorrect based upon the record. There is the notion, as Ms. Esquivel has clearly articulated, the CDPH has clearly articulated, is that Perez was only interested in the standard of care, and the hospital was only interested in, the CDPH was only interested in hospital violations. Well, first of all, the McComb testimony that was kept out clearly indicated that the CDPH was involved in precisely making sure that Dr. Chaudhry was punished, whether you call it more specifically, harsher.
Well, that's your gloss on it. Can you tell me why you think that? Because when you read the testimony, McComb says that's not what she was trying to do. She was just trying to say, you got to be more specific in how you know in whatever punishment you do give. I didn't sense anything from the testimony that they were saying, oh, you've got to take specific actions, you've got to be more harsh. So tell me what, I guess all this goes to is, even if you're right that there might have been some problem with admission, how is it prejudicial to your client? Because I didn't see McComb actually saying what you're now saying her testimony stands for.
I'm not supposed to ask questions of the panel, but firstly, I think we can draw some conclusions by the fact that she feigned forgetfulness about her prior testimony. This was somebody from the hospital asking for rewrites of a CDPH 2567. I don't know how much credibility we want to assign to Ms. McComb. And I guess I would have had the opportunity to ask those questions had the testimony been allowed in, but there is rewriting, send it back to the CDPH whatever you want to call it.
There's a specific question. So the state is telling you that they want harsher discipline visited on Dr. Chaudhry in the plan of correction. Is that right? And she says no. So she's saying, no, they weren't saying harsher discipline. They just wanted it, what we were doing, to be specified clearly. I guess I don't understand how that, even if she should have been allowed in, how that statement helps you.
I guess harsher discipline is in the mind of the beholder, Your Honor. I don't know that given the limitations that I had on questioning Ms. McComb, when you say more specific, with making sure he was not the head that he was removed as the head of a particular of the committee of a surgery director, again, to rely upon that single word, it's not harsher.
Where did you ask those follow up questions then? Because we're reading the testimony here where she said, no, I didn't ask for anything harsher. Did you follow up and say, well, what were you recommending? I mean, can you point us to other testimony that suggests she may have been asking for something harsher?
I wasn't allowed to get into that because she had clearly feigned forgetfulness about testimony that she had given very specifically years before. And so I wasn't allowed to get into
it. Where's the testimony that she gave years before that she was asking for harsher penalties?
The testimony years before was merely that she had asked for corrections. I don't think the panel.
And was that in the malpractice suit, the Perez?
Yes. She tested what the testimony I would have read was that there was more than one set of corrections, which, by the way, was the first time that it heard. It's not before the panel.
That doesn't seem at all inconsistent with her testimony in the record at 2 ER 181 to 182, where she said, no, we did ask for them to be more specific. I mean, what she says is, no, they wanted it specified clearly. instead of saying MEC met on 8/12 and discussed the incident and levied a suspension, she wanted it clearly laid out what education, what suspension, everything that MEC had for that particular incident. So
I don't think, sorry.
Go ahead.
I apologize. I don't think it's possible to look at McCombs' testimony in isolation from the blatant mistakes and frankly, what I have come to believe is Shirley Campbell's personalized arbitrary standard as to how to treat evidence that was being collected against Dr. Chaudhry.
Ms. McComb expressly confirmed that she thinks that Shirley Campbell is a person of integrity. You agree with that?
I guess that might go to some distance toward explaining why she didn't remember her prior testimony. I don't know that I would rely on Ms. McComb. What I would rely upon is the evidence in this case. And the 2567, before it was amended, was full of Ms. Campbell's personal spin, whether it was the misinterpretation or including false statements from Dr. Utrecht, whether it was taking Shore's testimony one way and reporting it completely differently, whether it was the blatant ignoring of the swipe cards, which ultimately I think resulted in the amendment of the.
Because you're bringing up a lot of these and you're kind of throwing a lot against the wall. So I mean, that's been what's hard about this case is peeling that back. Let's deal with the swipe card specifically. Okay, you've got a point, right? And it sounds like they did amend it. And honestly, that seems to be one of your strongest arguments, is that the report was amended, that he didn't leave at 11:45 a.m. He left at 12:15 p.m. But the question is whether that makes it is it still substantially true? And the testimony seems to be that even if he left the room at 12:15, he left before the patient was fully closed up. And that seems to be the gist of what's going on here. And your client even seems to agree that he left before the chest was fully closed. Now, there's a debate about what that means, but the factual dispute doesn't seem to be in question.
I don't think the issue is the chest closed up.
That does seem to be the issue, because that was the hospital policy, was that you couldn't leave before the chest was closed up. Now, I have no idea whether a doctor should be able to leave 5 minutes before or 10 minutes before, but that seems to be what the hospital policy was.
Let me peel this back a little bit, if I may. Maybe I have the disadvantage of having been the trial attorney. Sometimes that's an advantage, sometimes not. The issue about Dr. Chaudhry leaving at the 11:45 versus 12:15, the basis of that was it was a false reporting to ensure that there wasn't any question that Dr. Chaudhry had left too early, that he had left there wasn't even a determination that the patient was stable, because in effect he had scooted off to lunch while leaving unqualified people, a surgeon of 30 years and Ms. Alvacoba, where they didn't have a privilege card in advance, indicating that she couldn't do what he had left her to do. But setting aside that, the 12:15 to me is, I don't want to say a little bit of a red herring, but the issue is stability. The issue was...
Right. Okay, so let's go to stability. Because, I mean, the testimony seemed to be that he was not yet stable. He was oozing blood. Wasn't that the testimony from maybe I have it wrong, the PA?
You're talking about the perfusionist? Well, Alvacoba in part, and the perfusionist, whose testimony was a little bit all over the map, that the issue of stability, I think, was, you know, you've got Shirley Campbell's notes, and that they run contrary to her own statements in the 2567. And there are material differences in those, where she adds, in effect, testimony, evidence that's not in her own notes, blatantly, especially on the issue of stabilization. So the issue, they move the times, and I think we, you know, all of us can step back.
This is, you're referencing Albakova, right?
Or, I'm talking about Campbell's notes.
Well,
I'm sorry.
So I'm referencing Albakova. 2 ER 241, Albakova says she was concerned that the patient was oozing blood. And the question is, did the fact that this patient was having oozing, was that, as a PA, was that of any concern to you? It's always a concern, always a concern. And why is that? Because maybe patient needed to be watched longer. Maybe you need to add additional testing. I mean, it's just, like I said, it's not like I will order and will and we will do that. It's a surgeon's job. So,
well,
I mean, maybe
surgeon.
She's lying. Maybe she's misconstruing it. I don't know. But the district court, the question is, was he clearly erroneous and relying on that testimony to say the patient was unstable?
And just to follow up on that, is we understand what you're saying, your argument. It's, in a way, another closing argument. But ultimately, isn't the question here, given the standard of review, whether the district court was clearly erroneous in the determinations and conclusions that were made?
I think in the taking that as a question, I think in the context of the amendment of the 2567, of the manipulation of the reports that were prepared by the CDPH, the inconsistency in Mr. Shore's recollections and the use of those recollections, the animus displayed by Campbell by adding things that were not in her own notes, I think the court was erroneous in concluding. In my view, I think Judge Boone, discretion one thing, cherry picking is another. There was a considerable effort here to disregard any of Dr. Chaudhry's testimony, which I think was in sync with not only the amended, more of the amended 2567, but in terms of Ms. Campbell's notes, which did not support that Dr. Chaudhry had left the room prior to the stabilization. There's always, as the record makes clear, there's always going to be oozing. There's always going to be bleeding.
No,
the question is,
no. So, I mean, I'm not a doctor, but there's not oozing when the chest is closed. So, I mean, there's a question about whether the oozing and that it leads to stabilization, but I don't think it's fair to say that there's always going to be oozing.
I guess what I'm saying is some release of fluids is not inconsistent with stable with the patient being stable.
That may be. That may be. I don't know. But the district court found otherwise.
Yeah.
Could I? Sorry.
I
wanted to probe the liberty interest issue in this case, and I want to be clear in my own mind, your position. Does your client, does Dr. Chaudhry purport to have been deprived of a property interest, a liberty interest, or both? And please articulate the interests for us.
The interest was the right to a hearing, I believe. Dr. Chaudhry had an interest by way of his reputation, Stigma Plus, and had a right to have these reports considered in light of a full airing of all the facts, which didn't occur until.
But isn't the hearing the procedure that you think you need? But what was he deprived of? Was he deprived of some property, like his position at the hospital was property, or was he deprived of some liberty, like his position at the hospital was liberty? What are you saying exactly?
Yeah, I think there's some overlapping, you know, Venn diagrams here. The Dr. Chaudhry, the interest identified by Judge O'Neill was, I guess you would call it a quasi-property interest by way of his reputation and his ability to continue to function in the context of earning a living, being a lead surgeon, and all of those things. So, to my mind, there is a clear property interest that has been infringed here, and I think Judge O'Neill stated as much.
Do we know whether Dr. Chaudhry was foreclosed from all future employment? Does it matter whether he was foreclosed from all future employment?
Well, having left to Pakistan, I'm left to speculate. His income dropped to several percent of what he had earned before. So I don't know that whether he was foreclosed from all future employment or not is necessary to ask.
He's still licensed to practice medicine in California, right?
My understanding is yes, Your Honor. Though I don't think whether he's licensed or not doesn't mean there wasn't damage created by the dissemination of the inaccurate 2567.
We've taken you over your time, but we'll still give you a minute for a rebuttal, but let's hear from your opposing counsel.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. Diana Esquivel for the appellee's defendants. After a 5-day bench trial, the district court correctly found that plaintiffs failed to show that the statements in the published report were substantially false. Unless the court has some specific questions, I want to address two issues. The first, dealing with the swipe cards. The second, dealing with whether it was an abuse of discretion to exclude Ms. McComb's testimony. The court has already asked questions about the swipe cards, so I just want to elaborate on that since it's already been raised. First, the swipe cards themselves and the information regarding the swipe cards that were marked as plaintiff's exhibit 119 were not introduced into evidence. The only evidence regarding the swipe cards that was presented at trial was Ms. McComb's testimony as to why she did not consider the swipe cards a reliable source. During her testimony, she explained that in her experience, swipe cards are not reliable, or she did not give them greater weight in assessing her conclusions when she was drawing up her federal 2567, because as she mentioned in her testimony, that individuals sometimes lend each other their swipe cards, people hold doors for one another such that swipe cards are not needed to enter or exit a room. So in drafting her the federal statement of deficiencies, she did not give them.
But didn't
the
swipe card show that he left
to her attention?
Didn't the swipe card show that he left the room at 12:15 I'm not sure which, at 12:15 as opposed to 11:45? Wasn't that the basis for amending the report?
Yes, I can't say. I would just say, Your Honor, to answer the first part of your question, that it was a stipulated undisputed fact that Dr. Chaudhry left the operating room at 12:15.
So why did the report say 11:45?
Whether that was based, I'm sorry.
Why did the report ever say 11:45? How did that error creep in?
My understanding is that timestamp came from Mr. Youssef's, who was doing the state investigation interview of Mr. Schuer, the perfusionist, that originally that time was obtained from the perfusionist. I could be wrong. It might have been Miss Campbell during her interview, but it was during one of the interviews of the personnel in the operating room that led to and it might have been a confusion because 11:45 was the time that Mr. Perez came off the bypass machine around that time.
So when it's amended,
but in terms of going back to your
go ahead answer the rest the second part of
I was just gonna go the swipe cards. It was never conceded that the 12:15 time period was derived from the swipe cards. In the amended joint pretrial statement, fact number 25, that, again, this is a undisputed, a stipulated fact that the hospital provided, based on the hospital risk manager interview and a comparison with the clinical hospital records, showed that Dr. Chaudhry left the operating room at 12:15 p.m. It was never stipulated to that it was the swipe cards that confirmed that time.
Okay.
It was never stipulated.
I mean, to some degree, I think the swipe cards are not particularly relevant here. I'm more interested in what is the nature of the difference between 11:45 and 12:15 a.m. Obviously, this was 11:45 a.m. and 12:15 p.m. Obviously, this was a key period of time. And it seems like a lot could have happened in that half hour. And so I'd just be interested in your view on why when they write up a report that says he left at 11:45 a.m., that leads, to the patient wasn't stable, he wasn't closed up, all of these other things. Then they change it to 12:15, but they don't amend any of the other statements. It seems to me that that extra half hour would have had some relevance that probably should have been discussed about stability or policies or whatnot. So why was that the sole amendment that was made? Or am I wrong about that? Maybe more was amended than just that.
First of all, we don't know why it was amended because that was never introduced into evidence.
Okay, but I don't really care about that right now. I want to know. Right. Clearly, there was a report that was based on 11:45, and then they just change it and say 12:15, we got it wrong. But there's no discussion about the ramifications of what that has to do with the report.
I will address it in this manner, Your Honor, is that the time itself, for purposes of a stigma plus claim, has no significance because whether Dr. Chaudhry left at 11:45 or 12:15, the time itself that someone left at a specific time is not a stigmatizing statement. It's what the fact that he left when his patient was his chest was still open, his patient was still unstable.
My point is that extra half hour, there was a determination made that the patient was unstable at 11:45. And that Chaudhry left at that time. If you're going to change the time to 12:15, isn't there some duty to analyze that and say, okay, well, now we determined the patient was unstable at 11:45 a.m., but now we need to look at was the patient unstable at 12:15? And that doesn't seem to have been done, at least as far as I can tell, that they basically just said, well, who cares? It was really 12:15, but none of the other facts are different. Well, the facts were different. I mean, the patient was in a different position a half an hour later. Now, maybe he was still unstable, but I don't see that analysis being done.
Well, it was done, Your Honor, in the sense that when Ms. Campbell was interviewing the staff members that were present in the operating room. She wasn't looking specifically at times that events were occurring, although that was a consideration. It was also a sequence of the events and what information she was receiving from the person, from the medical staff that were present in the operating room. During her interview with the perfusionist, Mr. Schuer, he informed her that when Mr. Perez came off bypass shortly thereafter, Dr. Chaudhry left the operating room.
So your position is that
she received the same information from the nurses.
So I just want to be clear. Your position is that the 11:45 to the 12:15 had nothing to do with the progression of this. All the other testimony remained the same about the time and stage of the surgery that he left. They just had the time wrong initially.
Correct, Your Honor. And again, the matter of the time did not arise until a few years later, because the 2564 wasn't amended.
In my mind, the time raises a question about whether the investigation was properly done and how accurate it was. Now, and so I'm not sure. I mean, I'm interested in this view that a few years later you realize, oh, we've got a half hour wrong. And the assumption seems to be, well, yeah, but the stage was all the same. It's just we had the time wrong on the stage. And I just don't know. I'm interested in your view on what ties that together to lead to that conclusion. Maybe that's correct. I just didn't see any analysis of it.
Correct, Your Honor. And the reason there was no information about that at trial was because Ms. Campbell, who was a defendant, was not involved in amending the 25, the state report.
So can I ask and a again, follow-up question about this? So it seems like you're basically answering Judge Nelson that we have a series of events, let's call it a timeline. We thought that timeline sort of ended at 11:45, but in fact, the whole thing just shifts and it really ended at 12:15, but nothing changed about the timeline. Everything was half an hour later than we thought at one point. Is that supported, or were there tests and things done in between that we know the time, so we know that couldn't have been true, that it just was half an hour, everything was half an hour later?
What was presented at trial showed that the time of 11:45 was simply a mistake.
But were there things that, sorry, I just don't remember the exact, was there like any other evidence that we know happened at noon?
Yes, we have Mr. Schuer's note. He testified that he kept a contemporaneous note on his phone as the events were developing. And we submitted that with the supplemental excerpts of record, and I can provide you with the
exact
citation.
So if that's true, then how could the timeline just have shifted? It doesn't quite make sense. If we know something happened, say, in the middle of the timeline, and at one point we thought that was noon, now how could it all of a sudden be 12:30? It doesn't quite make sense, the answer to Judge Nelson, I think.
Right. So Mr. Schuer testified, and it was submitted into evidence about his contemporaneous note, that Dr. Chaudhry at 12:05 left the operating room when Ms. Albakova started closing the chest. So again, now we have a different time. Now he's saying 12:05. So this is where it was within the purview of the district court as a trier of fact to look at what does the time really mean when you have these conflicting testimonies. You had the testimony of Ms. Albakova, although she never stated a specific time. Her testimony was very clear that when she started, was about to put in the chest tubes and close the sternum, she saw Dr. Chaudhry heading towards the door and asked him, "You're not leaving, are you?" And he told her, no. And I'll be here. And then she saw him walk out the operating room. So as the trier of fact, the district court had times that didn't match up, but had testimony that said that Dr. Chaudhry, and it was within his purview to decide what way to give it, especially when the sequence of events, the evidence was more substantial to make it to show that Dr. Chaudhry had left, even though the time itself, the times 11:45, 12:05, 12:15 themselves could not be lined up. So when you have that conflicting evidence, as a trier of fact, the district court was fully authorized to make that credibility determination as to what weight it was going to give the times, what weight it was going to give the testimony of each of the witnesses, such that despite the inaccurate times or the conflicting times that Dr. Chaudhry left, in the overall, in the totality of all the evidence that was presented in trial, the district court found that it was the sequence of the way the events occurred that it was more likely true that Dr. Chaudhry left before the chest was closed.
Well, and didn't Dr. Chaudhry, this seemed to clinch it for me, and so correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Dr. Chaudhry actually acknowledge that he left before the chest was fully closed? And I thought his position was, you know, it was far enough along, I thought I was okay, and I left it in the hands of who, you know, surgeons that I thought were authorized to do this. Do I have the testimony wrong about that?
No, Your Honor. My recollection also is, and I'm sorry, I have not reviewed his testimony fully in a while, is that he left once the skin was being sutured. And that was his position. And according to Dr. Chaudhry's testimony, that was compliant with the hospital bylaws.
But doesn't that sort of crystallize what we're trying to decide? Because if he left when the skin was being sutured, that's a little bit different, it seems to me, than a statement that he left when the chest was open. You know, and that's what I'm troubled about by the government's report, is that the government report is kind of like, well, who cares about 11:45 to 12:15? Well, I think it could have had some impact. I mean, there's a big difference between leaving whether you got the chest, you know, gaping open with oozing blood, or whether you're just suturing up the skin because the sternum had been closed and other things. So can you address that? Because I'm just interested in what the response is. Wasn't there a duty for the government to go a little bit further and say, hey, we might have had some other facts wrong? Now, the gist of it isn't wrong. He still violated policy, but he may have violated it in a much less extreme way.
Well, Ms. Campbell did do her diligence, Your Honor. As she testified, she spoke to all the personnel staff. And again, just like the evidence that was presented at trial, she received conflicting statements from individuals. She received a statement from Mr. Schreuer that Albakova was about to start suturing the chest closed when Dr. Chaudhry left. She had the testimony of nurse, or the interview notes, her interviews of Nurse Bro, who said that Dr. Chaudhry left, as was his custom, to leave Albakova to close the chest and suture the skin. She had the interview notes from Miss Allen, and I believe it was Nurse Allen, and I apologize because there was another nurse in there, who said no, Dr. Chaudhry left once the skin was being sutured. So she did do her diligence, but based on the information that she had, she had the sufficient information to draw the conclusion that Dr. Chaudhry left when the chest was still open, And that was not a substantially false statement because she had evidence to support that statement, being Mr. Schreuer's statements to her, as well as Nurse Bro's. So the standard for a stigma plus is not whether the statements are 100% false. It's if they're substantially false, and that Ms. Campbell knew that they were substantially false. But the evidence presented at trial showed that she had a basis.
Now,
based on her interviews of the personnel staff, to conclude that this is what had occurred, that Dr. Chaudhry left when Mr. Perez's chest was still open. I'm sorry, Your Honor, had a question.
Yes. So the with respect to the suit under 1983, as I understand it, a plaintiff has an obligation to establish the conjunctive elements of a stigma plus due process claim, correct?
Correct.
So if one of those bases is not established, what happens to the claim?
It failed to meet their burden of proof, which is what happened here, but Judge Boone nevertheless still addressed the plus element of the claim. Here, after Judge Boone found that based on all the evidence that was presented at trial, plaintiff failed to meet their burden to show that the statements, the stigmatizing statements, were substantially false, and that Ms. Campbell, Mr. Lopez, were aware that they were substantially false. And Judge Boone could have stopped his analysis there, and that would have been proper. Judge Boone proceeded to also address the plus, the liberty interest at issue that was affected had the statements been proven to be substantially false.
And can you address in the few seconds remaining the causation question? Would a finding that CDPH somehow influenced or coerced the hospital's determination to discipline Dr. Chaudhry be decisive on causation?
No. No, it would not be, because that, first of all, never happened, as the court has already recognized it. Ms. McComb never said that the department, Ms. Campbell, or anybody else pressured them to levy stricter or heavier penalties against Dr. Chaudhry. But the causation also requires the but-for analysis, which Judge Boone adequately addressed. There was no evidence presented that Dr. Chaudhry contracts with the hospital were terminated because of any statements, assuming they had even published the statements, by Ms. Campbell or Mr. Lopez. There was a lot of evidence to show that during this, soon after, excuse me for a second. Sorry about that. That Dr. Chaudhry had several medical malpractice lawsuits pending against him, in addition to the Perez case, that the contracts with the hospital were still being fulfilled by Valley Medical. So even though Dr. Chaudhry himself had been removed as the chairperson, his practice, or the practice of which he was involved in, Valley Medical, was still fulfilling those duties and receiving the income. So given that evidence, the district court properly found that plaintiff failed to meet their burden to show that the loss of revenue and the eventual loss of the practice was caused by anything that the defendants did. And again, that's based on an assumption, had plaintiffs even met their burden to show that Ms. Campbell or Mr. Lopez published the statements, which the evidence showed that they never did, to the extent publishing, again, Judge Boone discussed it in the alternative, even assuming that he accepted that publication did not mean a wide dissemination of the information and was limited to the hospital. There was no evidence that Ms. Campbell or Mr. Lopez ever disseminated the information to anybody other than the CEO, who was responsible for responding to the statement of deficiencies. Unless your honors have any other questions, I see I've gone way over my time. I would submit and ask that you affirm the judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Because we went over time, let's give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. We can't hear you yet. I think you're still muted. Okay.
Thank you. It's ludicrous to suggest in a surgery that had the detailed kind of information as to what happened when, in the precise manner in which it happened, including Ms. Albakova's testimony, including the profusion of sure recollections, which I'll get to briefly in a second, which were utterly misused by CDPH, to suggest that skipping it forward half an hour doesn't change anything. It changes everything, because it puts Dr. Chaudhry...
Did Albakova have times in her description of the events?
No, she had the sequence of events that occurred throughout the surgery. Skipping it forward as though it doesn't change anything disregards the fact that the stipulation to the 1215 was a huge fact, because in effect what they were conceding was the chest was far more closed up and this patient was far more stable, and they didn't want to investigate that, and they wanted to put out a wrong number until they amended it. The key to the 1145 was precisely the issues that we've been discussing here, which was, what was the state of the chest, what was the state of the patient, and was he stable or not? The notion that Campbell engaged in a diligent work and believed some people rather than others doesn't explain why Mr. Shore's testimony, the interview that was taken, that was borrowed by from the feds back to the 2567, was a materially misstated interview, or why Ms. Campbell says something in her notes something in the 2567 that's not represented in her notes. These were material misrepresentations to make Dr. Chaudhry, and they didn't investigate it. They didn't investigate it until after whatever damage was done. It beggars any rational understanding of what the CDPH was doing.
Counsel, can I just advance? And I know we're taking you over, but I'd be interested in your response to what I seem to understand from the record, which is that at the end of the day, I actually agree with a lot of what you said, except that Dr. Chaudhry seems to suggest that he still left before the chest was fully closed. And, you know, whether it was on what spectrum of negligence that possibly was, he was violating policy at that time. Now, I think your response is that's not what the policy was, but say we find that the policy was that the chest needed to be closed before he left, there's no disagreement even from your client that he left at some stage before the chest was fully closed. Is that correct?
You know, one of the things that happens in medical malpractice cases, which I've done for years, is, you know, Dr. Chaudhry, after the fact, you know, 20/20 hindsight, said, you know, it wasn't a good result. There are probably things I could have done differently. I don't think the record reflects that he admitted to leaving before the chest was closed. The question is, what does the closing of the chest mean? Is it skin? Is it sternum? Is it the layers between? I think it is impossible not to recognize that by moving it forward half an hour, you're basically saying the chest wasn't closed, or moving it back half an hour, I guess is the way to say it, is the sternum wasn't closed. That you were, whatever you were allowing Ms. Albakova to do, which wasn't clear until privilege cards were created after the fact, whatever you were allowing to do, she wasn't allowed to do this. And you skipped out before really the surgery was completed. And when they moved it to 12:15, they acknowledged that that wasn't true. And that's why there was such a determined effort by Shirley Campbell in terms of her notes, in terms of Mr. Shore. I'll just end with saying, Ms. Esquivel says, well, the court can pick and choose from what it wants. And there's evidence there. And there was evidence there for Ms. Campbell. Well, like with Ms. Campbell, there was a substantial amount of evidence that Dr. Chaudhry had left well. The patient had a level of stability that allowed him to walk out when he left at 12:15, not at 11:45.
Thank you, both sides, for the helpful arguments. This case is submitted, and we're adjourned for the day.
Thank you very much. Everyone stay safe.